This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The NPR series Hard Times is on the road this month, visiting places and people feeling the pinch in this tough economy. For many charities and nonprofits and the people they help, hard times are getting harder. NPR's Sam Sanders visited a group called Free Arts of Arizona and has this report.
It's a clear, mild fall night in Phoenix. In a domestic violence shelter on the west side of town, Mario Barella is teaching children of abused women how to drum.
Okay, you guys ready? I start, you guys follow.
Most of the 20 or so children in the class come from families in distress. One parent, usually their mother, is fleeing an abusive partner. Most of these families are poor. I was allowed to sit in on the drum class, called Buckets of Fun, but I can't name or share the location of the unmarked shelter. I also can't disclose the names of any of the children here. There are kids outside the class who are too young to participate, peering through the windows of the small shelter cafeteria. A very pregnant program manager from Free Arts sits on the sidelines, tapping her baby bump to the rhythm. Her name is Jennifer Flowers. She says that arts therapy like this can work wonders for abused children.
It's awesome. I think the joy that these kids get to experience in this 1 hour with Mario is unparalleled by anything else that they get to do.
And for children dealing with serious problems in their families, Flowers says banging on paint buckets is one of the better ways to cope.
Because kids that have been through trauma so often turn to those negative things like drinking and drugs and self-mutilation. This is such a great way to be able to get those emotions out in a healthy, positive situation.
But for all the good these classes do, programs like Barella's are in danger. Like nonprofits all over America, Free Arts has been in a financial crunch for some time now.
We have lost half of our government funding. We've lost just about a third of our staff.
Barbara Finster is the executive director of Free Arts of Arizona. Besides layoffs and budget cuts, Finster says Free Arts had to stop hiring artists. And now, when businesses want to send volunteers to Free Arts, the nonprofit doesn't just say, come on down. They require a cash donation from those businesses as well. Even though people continue to give to Free Arts, the poor economy keeps donations down.
When they last year gave us at $500, this year they're giving us $400. Or a foundation that gave us $10,000 is giving us $7,500.
That, matched with cuts in government contracts and less support from philanthropic groups, can hurt.
You add the loss of 5% in government funding and the loss of 2% in foundation funding and the loss of, you know, whatever it is, the loss of 10% of individual giving, and now you're starting to talk about a significant decrease in your bottom line.
But Free Arts says they aren't giving up. They've matched cuts in staff and funding with increases in volunteers, many who are laid off and seeking new ways to fill their time. As the class winds down, none of these issues are on the kids' minds. They just want to know if Mario Barella will be back next week.
Are we going to do this every single Monday?
Barella says he will. The program isn't just for the kids. It helps him, too.
I mean, me, myself, a musician, business owner, artist, they're helping me to express and share my art form, and I mean, I'm able to get funds through them, you know, which puts food on my table. I appreciate that.
At the end of the class, Barella takes out a big plastic trash can. He's teaching the kids how to improvise. He keeps the beat. They make up their own over his. Free Arts is doing the same, improvising new methods of survival to keep the art they give alive. For Barella, it's worth it.
Like their slogan says, art heals, man, I believe it.
Sam Sanders, NPR News.
The failure of the Congressional Super Committee to reach a deal on reducing the federal deficit's being called another example of dysfunction in Washington, D.C. New attention is now focused back on the plan put forth last year by President Obama's bipartisan Deficit Reduction Commission, a blueprint that a number of Democrats and Republicans endorsed. Yesterday, we spoke with Alan Simpson, the former Republican senator from Wyoming who served as co-chair of that committee, and asked him why this super committee ended in such a super failure.
Well, what happened was it was almost loaded for failure. Don't forget, four of the people who were put on the 12 were on our commission and voted against it then. So, I mean, you got to figure, if four of them voted against it in the first go with the commission that Erskine Bowles and I co-chaired, that they probably weren't going to change their position on the 12. So there you loaded the commission with a third of it destined for failure. But what happened? Same old story, taxes and entitlements.
Hmm. Well, Senator, let me follow up with you on the matter of taxes. Because, of course, you're a lifelong Republican.
Sure.
The Democrats reportedly offered the Republican colleagues on this commission a package nearly identical to the Bowles-Simpson plan, but it called for only half as much in new taxes. As you note, Republicans still said no. Now, nobody likes taxes, but try to help us understand why so many Republicans are so staunchly opposed.
Well, you got Grover Norquist. He got 95% of the Republicans to sign a pledge that under no circumstances would they ever raise taxes, quote, without a corresponding cut. Now, he got most of them to sign up, you know, 10, 15 years ago. He is very, very powerful. But what can he do to you? The only thing he can do to you is defeat you for re-election. And if that means more to you than your country and your vote when your country is in extremity, you shouldn't even be in Congress.
Well, let me ask you about the man who under the Constitution is supposed to be the most powerful person in America, the President of the United States, President Obama. Has he been enough of a leader on this issue?
No, and it's disappointing. Let me tell you, I worked with Clinton. I enjoyed Clinton a lot, had fun with him. He never broke his word. George I, dear friend, Reagan, Carter, I respected those people. And I obviously have a feeling of this is my president, and I accepted the role here of a co-chair. But he's just sat it out. He left the country when Erskine and I turned in this report. But he did so because he knew that if he put it out there, he would be torn to shreds, which he would have been by his base. So he waited, and Paul Ryan, he said, look, if the mastodon in the kitchen is Medicare, then I'm going to deal with Medicare. And it is on automatic pilot. It doesn't matter whether you call it Obamacare, Elvis Presley care, I don't care care. It can't work, can't possibly work, unless be absolutely honest about that. And so Ryan puts that in and got torn to shreds, largely by the White House. So it's interesting work, and it's called politics, and it's in full force, but I've never seen it more vicious. I've never seen it more hostile. The word compromise apparently means you're a total wimp if you're a compromiser. The other thing is, for heaven's sakes, there are 82 new people there who didn't come to govern. They don't care about governing. They care about destroying government.
Senator Simpson, there's another downgrading of the U.S. credit rating at hand?
Well, Dick Durbin, give him a lot of credit. He voted for our package. Dick kept asking, where is the tipping point? Now, the tipping point, there's no need to bring a chart or PowerPoint with you. You won't know when it comes. And when it comes, it will be swift. And it will be the money guys calling the shots. If they say we're going to downgrade you, there's no question, but inflation will go up and interest rates will go up. And guess who gets hurt the worst? The little guy.
You sound frustrated. As frustrated as I've ever heard anybody in a position of influence.
I'm an American citizen first. I always felt that the party was second to anything I ever did. And so it is frustrating, but I'm more saddened than anything else to see people who worship their party above their role as a U.S. citizen, not a member of the NRA or the AFL-CIO or the AARP or the teachers. Whatever. What the hell is this? And that's where the bearings have come off the wheel, and the wheel has come off the car.
Former Republican Senator Alan Simpson speaking with us from Cody, Wyoming. Thanks very much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
The holiday shopping season started even earlier this year in hopes that consumers would spend more in these economic times. Macy's, Toys R Us, Target all moved up their opening times, in some cases to Thanksgiving Day. Joining us now to talk about Black Friday is NPR correspondent Yuki Noguchi. You've been reporting the scenes in stores. What can you tell us about the volume of shopping?
Well, anecdotally, stores are telling me that customer traffic and the amount of spending is up. We don't have any hard numbers yet, but I went to a downtown Washington Macy's, and it was very busy. And the store manager, Robert Booker, told me this.
I've never, ever seen anything. I mean, you know, we do have people waiting sometimes for store opening, but never more than 10, 15, 20 people. And to have, you know, well over 500 people waiting to come in for our specials is something I've never seen in the 20-plus years I've been with the company.
And, Scott, I heard versions of this from several chains who, you know, have similar stories across the country.
And of course, at the same time, we know how bad the job and housing markets are. Still, what's different about shopping this year?
Well, what's different is that people may be planning their spending a little differently, setting an amount that they want to spend for the holiday season and then backing into it. Let's say it's $200 or $300, and they want to get as much for that money as possible. Stores are opening earlier, which in a way creates more of a challenge for customers, like what to spend where and where to go first. But there are always people who love these kinds of logistics, like Tanya Bailey, who's a veteran Black Friday shopper in New York City.
The economy that we're having, any sale is a good sale. When we leave here, we're going to go to some other stores in the area. They have like the Fisher-Price toys for like $3.99 and JCPenney. So when we leave here, we're going to go there, then we're going to come back. Last year, we did 19 hours.
That's 19 hours of shopping. And this year she started at 9 p.m. on Thanksgiving Day.
Remind us, Yuki, why Black Friday is so important.
Well, because it's a barometer of consumer spending, which itself is a barometer for economic growth. And although it's only one day out of the holiday shopping season, last year it accounted for about 10% of the total holiday spend. That said, you know, a lot of people sit this one out. Only 20% of shoppers go out on Black Friday. And some say it's just diminishing in importance because so many people shop online these days.
There's been criticism again this year about Black Friday, a feeling among some workers that when you open a store on Thanksgiving night, you take the holiday away from your workers. I gather Target employees, for example, petitioned against opening on Thanksgiving night. What can you tell us about this employee backlash?
Well, certainly the earlier hours have inspired lots of critics who say, you know, we should just curb this kind of consumerism. But one of the biggest concerns that retailers had this year was actually safety. I talked to Kathy Granis at the National Retail Federation, and she told me this.
Large stores, department stores, had security lining the entranceway. In fact, a lot of retailers are even saying that there were additional training sessions this holiday season because the openings were going to be so early and they'd never experienced that kind of opening before and they didn't know what to expect.
You know, it's way before dawn when people are going out, and Granis says that sort of increases the potential for crime. There were actually at least two incidents of robberies and violence in parking lots, and there was even one shopper who used pepper spray against her fellow shoppers.
And NPR's Yuki Noguchi, thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Across the country, the typical college student of today isn't so typical anymore. Only one in four lives on campus and studies full-time, and most part-time students go as long as 8 years before finishing their degree. Higher ed schools are desperately looking for strategies to improve those numbers. NPR's Larry Abramson found one in Tennessee.
Many higher ed institutions brag about all the choices they offer. Lots of courses and majors to choose from. Pick your own schedule. But James King says for some students, choice can be the enemy.
We do not use the Burger King approach, have it your way, because most of the time, employers do not have that approach. You work according to a schedule that they set.
King is vice chancellor of the Tennessee Technology Centers, a state-supported career training program with 27 locations strung across this big state.
We have about 450 students this fall.
Good morning, Janetta.
This is the Murfreesboro Center, not far from Nashville. Carol Pereer is the director and den mother, you might say. She and the other staff do a lot of handholding to make sure that students get to their goal, a certificate and a job. Many community college programs let students pick and choose their classes. At the Tennessee Technology Centers, once students pick their program, their class schedule is decided for them.
They decide on the program, and they decide if they want to be full-time or part-time, and that's pretty much it.
Students don't have to worry that their schedule might change from semester to semester. For the 16 months she's enrolled, student Heidi Khanna knows exactly when she has to show up for her drafting courses.
7:45 to 2:30, Monday through Friday.
Attendance is taken, and it makes up about a third of your grade. It's a lot more like high school than the typical on-again, off-again schedule of many college students.
I am studying for a test right now. I'm in my architectural book.
Khanna is working on a computer-aided design program. Yes, architecture is in a slump, but Khanna is also getting the skills she needs to move into mechanical drawing. The technology centers work closely with advisors from local businesses to keep their program in sync with economic reality. That's one reason why around 8 in 10 students finish and get a job in their field. Amazing statistics for any higher ed institution, but it's still scary leaving the nest.
Are you nervous at all about investing this much time? Will you get something out of it?
I'm scared to death. I don't know. Scared of change, you know. Just getting back out into the workforce.
Heidi Khanna already has a degree, but her AA in liberal studies wasn't getting her the work she wanted, so she's starting over again at age 39. Other students plan to use their certificate to get a job to pay for more schooling. 23-year-old Jeremy Miller already has an offer to become a surgical technician. His earnings will rise to around $40,000 a year.
Yeah, that'll do for me. That's better than what I'm making now.
Yeah, what are you making now?
Nothing. Next August, I plan on starting where I left off the first time I went to school with my prerequisites to start my bachelor's degree in biology, and then hopefully off to med school after that.
Transferring to a new school is a big challenge for many students, but the technology centers have good arrangements with other colleges in Tennessee so the students here can continue without losing credits. The centers have followed pretty much the same program for over 40 years, and it's actually a pretty old school model. Create a closely knit program like a small Ivy League school. Now, as more schools realize just how bad their college completion rates are, they're looking in this direction. Next September, the City University of New York will open a brand new school called the New Community College, with Scott Evanbeck as president.
We've designed a curriculum and co-curriculum that everyone will go through together, and the students will all be, at least in the first year, enrolled full-time.
These schools are building on evidence that shows many students simply take the wrong classes or they can't get into the right ones. Either way, they waste time and money. The longer they take, the more likely they are to drop out. And the new community college will also start with a summer program that introduces students to the school and each other.
Then when they come in the fall, they'll have an intact schedule where a cohort of students will take everything together.
There are signs this approach has promise for 1- and 2-year students. The question is whether these tightly focused programs have something to teach bigger 4-year schools where graduation rates are also pretty low. Larry Abramson, NPR News.